All right, Dr. Maurice, I think we're ready for your introduction.
Okay. Well, I want to welcome everyone. This is Charles Maurice of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. I'm very happy to welcome you to the third seminar in our biweekly seminar series on cumulative risk assessment. Before we begin with today's seminar, I have a few quick house cleaning items to address. First, whether you are listening to today's seminar via teleconference phone line or via audio streaming through your computer, you can view the slides either directly from the CLUIN website or by downloading them and viewing the saved file. We generally recommend prior downloading of the presentation slides in order to avoid potential response lags due to high volume participation. If you are using a teleconference phone line, please ensure that your phone is muted. If your phone does not have a mute function, you can press #6 or you can press *6 to mute and #6 to unmute. Whatever you do, do not put us on hold, as this frequently leads to us being serenaded with music or worse, a repeating recorded message. Please hold all questions until the end of the presentation. At that point, we will alternate between questions provided over the phone and questions typed in to the CLUIN website. The objective of this seminar series is to create a common base of knowledge and understanding regarding cumulative risk assessment, and in the process, facilitate and enhance the dialogue that must be conducted in order to further the science and practice of cumulative risk assessment. The seminar series is being held every other Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time until July 14. Starting with today's seminar, the slides and audio for the rest of the seminars will be freely accessible and archived on the CLUIN website. Please allow 2 to 3 weeks after each seminar for posting of the recording. The slides and audio for Linda Tuschler's seminar of 2 weeks ago have been archived on the EPA Environmental Science Connector web portal. Anyone wanting instructions to access the Environmental Science Connector should send me an email at maurice.charles@epa.gov. That's maurice.charles@epa.gov. The Cumulative Risk Assessment Seminar Series is leading up to a primarily internal EPA workshop being held July 28 to 30 at the EPA Region 5 offices in Chicago. The workshop is being sponsored by the Office of Science Policy within EPA's Office of Research and Development. It will bring scientists and researchers from across EPA's regional offices, program offices, laboratories, and research centers to move cumulative risk assessment forward by discussing tools, methodologies, and applications, and by identifying research needs and obstacles to practice. Today's seminar is the third in the series and will be presented by Dr. Susan M. Cormier of the National Center for Environmental Assessment within EPA's Office of Research and Development. Dr. Cormier received her BA from the University of New Hampshire, her MS from the University of South Florida, and her PhD from Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Before joining the EPA, Dr. Cormier was an assistant professor at Vassar College in New York and at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Dr. Cormier is a senior scientist with the EPA and has authored more than 80 peer-reviewed publications. She has been a regular presenter and workshop instructor at national CTAC meetings since the 1980s, CTAC being Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. Dr. Cormier has made substantive contributions to the development of methods for biocriteria and chemical criteria, condition assessment, and ecological risk assessment. She co-led development of both the U.S. EPA stressor identification guidance and the CADIS website, which she will be talking about today. finally, I think a part of what makes Susan an outstanding EPA scientist is her stated philosophy that caring about the environment is not enough. You also have to care enough to try to do the right thing. And with that, I give you Dr. Susan Cormier. Susan?
Yeah, thank you very much for that kind and rather long introduction. I was getting ribbed here back in my hometown. But I'm glad to be here and share some ideas, not only for myself, but for my whole CADIS team that I've been working with for the last several years, which represents a fair number of folks from the Office of Research and Development, as well as the program offices and regional offices in EPA, as well as state folks who have really inspired us to try to do what we can for the environment. So I really do appreciate all of you here today. We're going to try to go through this fairly quickly. We'll see how far we get. I have an awful lot of material to cover, and we'll just see if we really can cover all this. So if we could, without further ado, go ahead to the next slide. And what I want to point out is that what I'm going to present today is, you may be more familiar in this whole group, is come together to talk about cumulative risks. And I'm going to focus more on before the risk, if you will, or the causes. And so some of the things I have to say today will benefit both questions of cumulative risk, but you may also be interested in cumulative causes. And I've structured the presentation in three sections. One is the assessment of cumulative causes. Second is CADIS. And the third is a case study to give it a little bit more concrete feel for you. Okay, so I want to point out that there are differences if you're doing a causal assessment versus a risk assessment. In a causal assessment, you start with an effect. Either you know that you have this effect and you're trying to figure out what the cause is. So given E, what is C? In a risk assessment, you have the cause already identified. You have a contaminant at a site or some chemical that you want to set criteria for. And so you are given C to begin your assessment. And then you're trying to figure out what the effect might be. So these are two different things, and I've depicted this with the arrows going in different directions to give you that sense that it's not exactly doing the same thing. So what you start with are different questions. You end up doing different analyses, and it requires a different logic be applied to the problem solving. Oh, okay, and I'm sorry, I should tell him when to change his slides. What slide number are we on?
Four.
Four? We're on slide four. So on slide four, there are different questions, there are different analyses, and different logic that are applied to answering these different kinds of assessment questions. And if you go to slide five, that means you're going to have different types of assessments. So how can you keep all of these things sort of straight? Last time we had a seminar through this group, Linda Tischler, you know, shared with us a little bit of pedigree about cumulative risk, especially to humans. But, you know, we can think about this as a larger paradigm that can also be relevant for all environmental assessments, including ecological risk assessments and ecological causal assessments. So I'm going to give a basic paradigm for environmental assessments to try to orient you to see the connections between causal assessments and risk assessments and how cumulative causes affect both types of assessments. So if you go ahead to slide number six, you'll see a very basic matrix. And this is a basic environmental assessment framework. And there are four things here. There's a condition assessment, causal assessment, predictive assessment, and outcome assessment. And what this matrix is going to show you is that if you use this sort of terminology, it makes it more sometimes can make it easier to communicate across assessment types and programs. So if you go to slide 7, you'll see that I'm highlighting a column of assessment types here. And these two types, condition assessment and outcome assessment, are how you identify that you have a problem in the first place, or that something you think you solved after trying to fix it you didn't solve, and in an outcome assessment. If you go to slide 8, this column on the right-hand side is problem resolution. This is how you solve your problem, by doing your causal assessment, and then you identify what it is you got to fix, and if you fix the right thing in the predictive assessment box, then you have solved your problem. If you go to slide 9, you'll see that the top row is highlighted. This row are assessments in which I mentioned previously. You start with an effect, and you're figuring out the cause. And we usually refer to these as environmental epidemiology, and we're trying to figure out the cause or the source. If you go to slide 10, you should see, come on, you can do it. If you go to slide 10, this row is how is environmental management. This is where you're actually implementing controls in place and determining whether or not you have an outcome. In this case, this is where you're beginning with a known cause, and you are trying to achieve a particular effect. So you see the little boxes all sort of fit together, and if you end up in slide 11, you'll see it's just a general matrix outlining the relationship between different types of assessments and how they all work together. If you go to slide 12, this is an example from what a lot of people tend to think about, or what I think most of the folks here on the phone tend to do, and these are risk assessments. And this is where you're trying to predict an effect that might occur from some chemical, or an outcome that might occur if you remove that particular stressor or number of different many causes that are going on and active at a location. Or you might be trying to do criteria setting. And in this, you would simply start in this predictive assessment box because you're predicting what's going to happen. You're starting with an assigned chemical or a mixture, and you're estimating the exposure. You're developing a model of the causal relationship between your assessment endpoint and your exposure, and you estimate the effect. And I'm sure everybody on the phone is very familiar with that process. In criteria setting, for instance, you would be, again, making a prediction that if I lower a level of this stressor or of concern to some level, that I should be protective of the environment or of people. So you're taking into account, you know, the goals as well. Okay, if you go to slide 13. Now, you know, what if you were in a situation where you wanted to know whether or not a stream was actually meeting the Clean Water Act requirements for aquatic life use? And this is where you go in and you're measuring the condition in the stream, the biological components in the stream, and comparing it to your criteria. And in this case, you're doing a condition assessment. And next slide, 14. What if, for example, there is a species that has becoming nearly extirpated and threatened, such as the branching corals in the, actually worldwide, but here in the United States, your proper corals are now listed as threatened and endangered species in the Caribbean. In this case, you can see things start to get a little bit more complicated than the simple ones I showed you in terms of the assessments. You're going to have to link assessments together. So in this case, you know you have a problem the effect, and you want to figure out the cause. Why are the corals disappearing? And what are the source of those different stressors that are causing that decline? And then once you know what those things are, which one of them can you control in some way or reduce? And that's what you deal with in the risk assessment. What options might you have for doing that? And they come up with 5 or 6 options, and then you have to pull in the societal concerns about implementing any of those risk management strategies. It will include economics and just other logistic constraints. And then hopefully, you know, controls would be put into place and you would begin to see the corals recovering, and you would be looking at that in an outcome assessment. And of course, that's not going to happen the first time around. Not everything's going to be perfect. So there's a little bit of a feedback loop of adaptive management. And hopefully what will happen is that recovery will occur and that the corals will be taken off the endangered species list. And that is your problem resolution in the center, which we've been aiming at through each one of these examples. Now, all the cases I've just shown you tend to be ones typical for what we do in ORD, where we have lots of time and we think about it and we come up with how we're going to take the years, and finally we come up with an answer. But sometimes nature doesn't agree with that plan, and we have a hurricane thrown at us. Or some other thing that requires an immediate decision because the risks are bearing down on us. In this case, you can just bypass some steps that you would normally have to do and just start immediately into an adaptive management action or go immediately to a risk assessment, start putting things in place, and then you may go back and do some deliberative type assessments after the fact. So you can start in any place in the box. The arrows can go forward, backwards. You can design anything you want with this sort of thing. But generally speaking, it's nice to have in your mind, am I going from the cause to the effect, or am I going from the effect to the cause? You know, am I in a problem-solving mode? Am I in a problem detection mode? And it's best to keep those things clear in your mind when things get pretty complicated. Okay. So if you go to slide 16, I want to introduce a website that can help with some of these types of assessments that our team has put together. And this is the Causal Analysis, Diagnosis, and Decision Information System, CADIS for short. And the focus of this particular site is for causal assessment rather than for predictive assessments, the risk and management type assessments. However, there's a lot of good information on here that everybody can use, whether they're looking at a single stressor or they're looking at cumulative stressors that they're interested in, or mixtures. So if you go to slide 17, where we're focusing on is an eco-epidemiological assessment, the top row, where somebody has seen that there is a biological problem or an effect, and we want to do the causal assessment. And the CADIS, in case you are unfamiliar with some of the critters that crawl around in the bottom of our streams, the CADIS is sort of a little spinner takeoff for the geeky ecologists in our group. And you can see that there's a caddisfly larvae on the left. This one is actually one that's been fed little stones or provided little stones that it uses to make its case, just like a butterfly would make a cocoon or some protective cover. It makes this little cover. This one happens to be made out of gold and pearls and opal, but most caddisflies have to deal with the regular little granite rocks and sandstone rocks or picks of wood to make their case. So that's a caddisfly if you've never seen one. An adult on the right. And we use, in ecological assessments, we often use a lot of different invertebrates and streams to make an assessment of the quality of that stream. All right. Enough fun stuff. Here's the website on slide 18. This is the home page. And the home page is, you know, kind of has some advantages. You can do a search on it. There's a left nav bar to help you find things. In this particular case, you can see these two pictures on the right-hand side. I'm going to present that particular information about that particular site later on in the case. That's the Willimantic River in Connecticut. The website has, if you go to slide number 19, it has a lot of material embedded in it. I don't remember how many pages are on this website. It must be up to 400 pages by now. This one is about listing multiple stressors as candidate causes and strategies for addressing them in a causal assessment. I could give a whole presentation on this alone, but I will just refer you to this particular page in the website if you'd like to look at, you know, when should you aggregate, when should you separate different causes, what causes tend to come appear simultaneously, how do you deal with interaction, how do you deal with confounding. You know, these sorts of things are problems that are addressed whether you're doing a cumulative risk assessment or a causal assessment in which you have multiple potential interacting causes. If you go to just a little bit more tour of the website and what kind of materials you might find useful, if you go to slide 20. I don't know, did it work? Yeah. New slide 20. This is just a basic step-by-step guide section of the website that will help you walk through a causal assessment as opposed to a risk assessment. They're really very similar. There's a planning, there's something that initiates a causal assessment, just like in a risk assessment. Somebody says, we got a problem, let's deal with this. There's a planning phase in which you're trying to figure out, gathering some information, what should you do, how do you deal with the scope of the problem. And then there's an analysis, you know, phase to it where you're actually crunching numbers and gathering evidence and information. And then finally a synthesis stage where you have to pull it all together to figure out, in our case, what's the probable cause. And then, hopefully, something happens afterwards. If we come up with an answer and nobody does anything, it's not very satisfying. So an important thing is to make sure that information gets to the right people so a decision can be made and something can happen. If you go to slide 21, here you can see a section of CADIS which deals with different candidate causes. Now because we're dealing with ecological issues, we don't just deal with toxic chemicals. So this particular site introduces people to many different possible causes that they might encounter that could degrade a stream. And they may include things like you see in this image, which is suspended sediment, which is shading maybe and killing plant growth in the stream, or in the case of the Chesapeake Bay, where it's killing the seagrasses. It could be falling out and settling in the stream and embedding it, or you can actually have sediment starvation where you don't have enough sediment like below a dam. So we have different kinds of stressors, and they would be probably more interesting to ecologists, but we also have on the site stressors that are also relevant to humans, such as unknown toxics that you might encounter and so that site is useful for that purposes. It's also useful in that it provides information on sources, site evidence when you're looking at a stream, how do you know what's going on, what might be wrong with it just by looking at it, the biological effects that are likely to be associated with that particular cause and ways to measure these different stressors in streams. If you go to slide 22, now what about analysis? What do we provide to help people with crunching their numbers? What we have is a section called Analyzing Data, and this section provides a number of things. First of all, it cautions people on the use of statistics, which is really important, what's appropriate to use for a causal assessment, what's not. It provides a little GUI interface that if you have data and you want to bring it in, you can. It will do simple statistics, help you do simple statistics using a free open source statistical package called R, as in the letter R, And there are also scripts that you can download and use to do these statistical analyses. And that's helpful for some states who don't have statistical packages at their disposal. Some states do, but some states don't. But once you have a curve, let's say you have modeled some sort of causal relationship, and you want to be able to interpret that with respect to your particular site. And so you can see in this particular slide 22 that we have a couple of different plots of data, and the site is sort of illustrated potentially as a little red circle. So what these pages do in CADIS is help you to interpret, well, what does it mean though about my site? I might have this relationship that we know that exists between sediment and the biological community, but what about my site? Is it bad? Is it good? What's the likely chance that it's a cause? So it helps you to interpret the information from your site. Slide 23 is an illustration of another part of our website, which are the conceptual models. And I know this looks like a pretty complicated little slide here, but what the beauty of this thing is that it's in PowerPoint, and you nab these things and pull them off, you can delete as many of those little boxes as you like and simplify it, or you can add things to it. So it has a practical advantage. If you want to be able to show the relationship between sources or human activities that's going on in the landscape through the various processes and intermediate stressors that might occur and the biological effects at the end. So those are the conceptual model pages. That's the tour of CADIS, and now I want to give you a case to make the sort of concrete some of these concepts. So slide 24, I'm going to step you through using the basic environmental assessment framework, this particular case. And so we're going to start with the condition assessment. And in this particular case is the Willimantic River in Connecticut. And what normally happens in Connecticut, as in a lot of states, stream biologists go out and they collect invertebrate and fish samples from a stream, as well as water chemistry sometimes, and information about the habitat as well. And they use that to assess the condition of the stream. And just because you might not be so familiar, if you go to slide 25, here are some of the organisms that you might encounter. So stream organisms that we like to see in a stream are things like mayflies, stoveflies, and caddisflies, the top row of organisms. And here's some wonderful pictures that are available from the North American Benthological Society. And I've included both the adults and the larval forms. So the creepy crawly things up at the top that look kind of scary are really tiny, but don't be afraid to go in the stream. And these are the juvenile forms, the larval forms that are in the water. And then when they emerge, they fly away. And they're like damselflies and dragonflies, things that you're more familiar with as terrestrial organisms. But they have a life stage, sort of like a caterpillar stage, that they're in the water. Now the ones in the bottom that have been indicated in the black row at the bottom, these are things that shouldn't normally be in high densities in your stream. So we have black flies, they bite, we have chironomids, snails that have an internal sort of a lung called pouch snails that are able to sort of hold their breath, if you will, underwater. These indicate the water quality is more like a wetland or a pond rather than what a stream is supposed to be like, so we know that there's a problem. So if you go to slide 26, we not only want to see the presence of certain sensitive species, but we don't want it to look like this. We don't want it to be all the same critter covering the bottom of the stream. We like to see a lot of diversity. That means there are a lot of different habitat niches for these organisms to appear. So what was happening in the Willimantic River? So if you go to slide 27, on slide 27, here's a little map, topo map for Connecticut. You can see that the Willimantic River is in the right-hand upper corner of the state. It's mostly forested land here. The state has to report to Congress in the 303D list or 305B list what water bodies are impaired. And rather than going out to the stream, which would seem logical, they just don't have enough time. So what they did is they looked at the records for the wastewater treatment plant, which they call publicly owned treatment works. And what they did with this was they looked at the amount of release, what was being released to the stream, and they, based on those releases, they said copper, lead, and zinc is probably too high, and we've got to deal with a TMDL in this case. A total maximum daily load has to be estimated and a reduction in these chemicals, because no doubt the biology is impaired below this wastewater treatment plant. So they listed it on the 303D list. And then if you go to slide 28, they went to a place in the watershed in a tributary where there was no other wastewater treatment plant. They had expectations that it was a good site, and this is a little trip called Roaring Brook. And you can see this images in this picture. And this stream, you can see, has lots of rocks and it's idyllic looking. And sure enough, the benthic invertebrate community is pretty nice in this location. They used it as a reference. Then if you go to slide 29, they went below the wastewater treatment plant in the stream, and you can see that in the bottom slide. And indeed, this site was biologically impaired. It kind of looked like a lot of worms and not many of those mayflies, stoneflies, and caddisflies. Yeah, so they went, see, that's what we said. And then they went upstream of the wastewater treatment plant, and oops, it was also impaired. So it wasn't necessarily the wastewater treatment plant. And see, you're already starting a source assessment when you're doing this. So now we're in the source assessment. Okay, so, let's see, where are we? So if we go to slide 30, here you can see different places in the watershed that they've looked at the stream community. So this bar chart shows you the scores that they're looking at to assess the condition of the stream. And what you can see is that when the bars are blue and green, those are at least meeting minimum sort of our nearly minimum requirements for water quality with respect to the aquatic life. But then you can see in those sort of like orange ones, MR3, WL1, and WL2, that these things are pretty low. These are the two sites right next to the wastewater treatment plant. And then they started going upstream. In fact, they started running all over the watershed going, what the heck's going on? Where? How big a problem is this? And at MR3, which was upstream from the wastewater treatment plant, but further upstream, it was also impaired. But at MR1, which was on a tributary, it was not. So they're starting to identify where the problem is. And so if you go to slide 31, now they have decided the extent of the problem from that red line up into the Middle River and heading down into the Willimantic. So now they've clearly identified and finished their condition assessment, and now it's time to figure out the cause. What was causing this problem? So if you go to slide 32, we're now entering the causal assessment part of the framework. And if you go to slide 33, I want to remind you that there are two different types, at least, of causation that you have to think about. Specific causation is when you're looking in a particular case, what is the cause? So, did smoking cause my cancer? You know, or will my smoking cause cancer to me? All right. Or if you're looking at general causation, it's different. It's generally speaking, does smoking cause cancer? And in a risk assessment, you might be asking, can smoking cause cancer? In this particular case, we are looking at specific causation. We want to know in the Willimantic what caused the decline of the invertebrate community in the stream. So if you go to slide 34, you'll see that we have the two types of causation, the specific causation and general causation, and we're going to want to get evidence to figure out what that specific cause is. And we will use sources of evidence right from the case, measurements directly from the Willimantic River. But we'll also go out to what we know about from other streams and from general knowledge of ecology and toxicology to try to figure out amongst all the multiple causes that could be going on in the stream, you know, is it one cause, is it five causes, what's going on in the stream. We'll also access evidence from elsewhere or from general knowledge about general causation. In the process, we use a number of different approaches and strategies. One is refutation, where if something is impossible, it doesn't occur at the site, for instance, we can refute it. We also use diagnosis, which is symptomology, which is looking at positive information or positive evidence that will help us to say this is the cause or affirms the cause. Or you can use diagnosis to also refute, so if you are lacking the symptoms that you expect. And then lastly, we use weight of evidence. And we often have to rely very, very heavily on weight of evidence, at least in the cases that we've encountered. If you go to slide 36, I want to just briefly point out a difference between how we use causal relationships in a risk assessment versus in a causal assessment. Remember, I mentioned before that with different types of assessments, you're using different kinds of logic. You will use a causal model, the same causal model, but you won't necessarily use it the same way. So in slide 36, you can see a logistic regression from the Mid-Atlantic Highlands part of the country with respect to the good stream invertebrates I introduced earlier and the amount of sediment in the stream. And what this says that, for instance, at an exposure, let's say you had a stream that had an exposure level of 30% fines, you then say, what's the risk? And the risk is that you have about a 75% chance that you would see less than 9 of those types of species or taxa in the stream. So you see you're going from the cause to making a prediction about the effect. If you go to slide 37, we're going to look at it from the causal assessment perspective. And in this case, what you can see is, let's say, for instance, I have at my site 30% fines. What's the probability that I would see less than that? Yeah. What I want to look at here is I look, as you can see, the little arrow, and that's the 50% or 50% probability of observing less than 9 EPT. And what I want to know is my risk or my chance of seeing an effect going to be greater? Is it greater at that cause or not? So if my little, you can see the little red cross, if that represents what my site is, you know, what is the probability, am I above 50% or below 50% probability that I would see this exposure? So you're using it in a little bit different way. So in this particular case, it's greater than chance alone that effect would have occurred. So let's go back to the river in slide 38 and see what happens. The folks went back and took some additional samples in the stream, not only at the site, but in other locations, in Furnace Brook in slide 38, and in the Middle River in slide, in Furnace Brook in slide 38, 39, and Middle River in 38. And they came up with a list of candidate causes on slide 40. And you can see that there's a number of different things, toxicity, high flows, quite a long list. And if you go to slide 41, we start to look at evidence, different types of evidence adapted from Hill's criteria. And then we do a scoring to look at that evidence, and we weighed it depending on what was the source of the information and the quality of the evidence. So we're sort of splitting things up a little bit using Hill's criteria. The three sorts of things that we separate the sources of information is observations, manipulations, and general knowledge. And the quality of evidence comes from the case, comes from things like specificity, the quality of the study, consistency, and other qualities. At any rate, after we collect all the evidence of what's going on in the case, we go ahead and put it together in a table depicted in number 42. So you can see that in this slide, this is the weighted body of evidence. Spatial temporal co-occurrence is the first line, and you can see sometimes we had something present like metals. Other times we didn't have really much ammonia present. We had silt present, but we didn't have low DO. At any rate, you go through this and you go ahead and score it for different types of evidence that are suggested on the CADIS website. And in this particular case, we did two iterations. In the first iteration, the answer was, we don't know. We couldn't really quite figure out what was going on, but we were very suspicious, and we suggested that they go back and collect some more information, and based on that, more information was collected. There was a manipulation that was very strong, and you can see that's highlighted, and so the actual cause that was identified was an episodic mixture that was occurring in the stream, and that's tough to show because it's coming only every so often. It's not all the time, and it wasn't just one substance, it was a mixture. If you go to slide 43, we figure that out. What happened was we knew about where the stressor first appeared and the effect appeared, or at least where the effect appeared. We recommended going up just a little further up the stream to isolate some other potential causes, such as a dam, and some other industry that was located there. And you can see that site, MR2, which is in blue, is better than the downstream location. So we knew where to look. And when they looked in that picture up in the top left, they actually found a very old, from the 1800s, a granite chase that ran underneath an old mill, a woolen mill, that was still operating every so often in batches. And somebody that had put a big heavy load on their loading dock, and under the loading dock was a wastewater treatment plant line. And it had cracked, and right below it was this raceway that used to power the mill a long time ago, the water running through it. And so it was every so often, they'd have a batch, they'd release it, the stuff would go into this raceway, come under the road and under the mill, and eventually pour into the stream. And no one even knew that this raceway was there anymore. It had been forgotten. It was covered by trees and brush. You couldn't see it. And by luck would have it, when the folks from Connecticut went out into the stream to do that additional collecting, they happened to hit it just right. But even if they hadn't, they would have been able to localize it. So how do you present this kind of information? One option is to go back to the conceptual models. Here's one that's been simplified for the case, and show the evidence. So you can see that on the right-hand side of slide 44, there was an unknown source, and that was dumping an episodic mixture that was killing the animals. And it's highlighted in blue, and the evidence is, or gray, and it's, and the evidence is presented here. Whereas other potential causes are with the dotted lines, and the evidence is provided for them showing those were very unlikely. If you go to slide 45, one of the concerns was after this stream, they identified that one cause. There were some streams that are highlighted here with an orange circle that they was going, well, you know, these guys aren't really coming up to that line of moderate. They're still moderately impaired, and we would really like to see this improved. And in the upper picture, you can see that there are a lot of impoundments or little dams throughout this area. And this was identified as the cause of these, as heat and altered food resources coming from the stuff in the behind the dam. And I'm going to skip slides 46 and 45, but I thought you might like to have 46 and 47. But I thought you might like to have those to sort of see a summary of the causal assessment and the risk assessment, what was done. So, but in brief, on slide 46, what happened was the state fixed the pipe. And they didn't have to do a risk assessment because it was law that you can't dump this stuff in the stream. And they expected it was going to get better. They didn't see how they could remove the dam because of the social issues associated with it, so they decided to study the dam some more. And also to look at another possible cause, which is the impervious surfaces in the town. And, all right, so if we then go to the outcome, I don't want to leave you guys hanging, but there was an outcome. Did this stream get better? And, of course, you know this is a Hollywood story that I'm presenting today. So if you go to 48, we're going to talk about the outcome assessment. And 49, you can see that in 1999, the stream, you know, wasn't doing very well. It was only performing at 25% of what the reference site was like, that pretty roaring book I showed you in the beginning. And that after the little star was where they fixed the broken pipe, the illicit discharge, slowly there was recovery, and then finally in 2003 it popped over the little red line and was no longer impaired. And that was true for right where the raceway was, but also above and below the wastewater treatment plant. Okay? So after that, I just want to leave you with slide 50 and remind you that the CADIS website is there for you to use. I clicked it, but it doesn't go. I think everybody's clicking. CADIS is a guide to causal inference for specific cases. There's the website. And I'm really dangerous here, but there's my email address and my phone number. And then if you go to the last slide, it's a little advertisement for the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. They have a number of regional locations or chapters, and CTAC, at this meeting, they are going to be offering a short course on doing causal assessment and sort of a day-long version of this very quick overview. And without further ado, I will leave it to questions.
Thank you very much, Susan, for an excellent presentation. And I just want to call attention to those listeners who happen to be more human health-oriented. These same principles that Susan was describing here in an ecological context can be used for human health risk assessment as well. And in fact, one of the characteristics of cumulative risk assessment is the integrating of human health and ecological risk assessment. And that brings up that next week, the next seminar in 2 weeks is going to be presented by Dr. Glenn Suter, also of the National Center for Environmental Assessment at EPA, and he will be addressing the topic of human health and ecological integration. Okay, I guess we'll start with questions from the phone. We have about just under 10 minutes for questions until the hour. Okay, we can switch over to, as people are formulating their ideas and their questions, we can switch to the computer submitted questions. Susan, you can read those, correct, on your screen?
No. Oh. I popped them up. I could before, but there, if there's anything up there, there's nothing up there.
All right, well, this is Andrew Geller. I have a question for you. Both on the health side and on the eco side, we're moving toward, at least some parts of the laboratory are moving toward looking at toxicity pathways and trying to make what are really are causal links of mechanistic pathways or key events that could be measured as you have in terms of identifying a broken pipe. But it can also be, we can take this down many, many levels of scale to almost cellular mechanisms. And we're trying to apply this both to human health and to ecological risk assessment. Is this Susan? Have you talked with folks working on the kind of the toxicity pathways in the 21st century about adapting this kind of framework to that mechanistic level?
Yeah, I didn't. You know, there's a lot of material to cover, and I wanted to give a good background for it. I mean, we could have gone into some of the types of evidence that we use for to establish a causal relationship, as well as and included in that are some of the mechanistic things. But you know, I didn't feel like I had time to go into that kind of level of detail. But yeah, and the other thing I think that's important with the conceptual models is in terms of thinking about exposures and thinking about other factors that are influencing those exposures and trying to make all those linkages. I think to some extent, ecological assessments have been doing this for a long time, looking at populations and predicting the risk of what will happen. And that more dialogue between human health risk assessors and ecological risk assessors can only be beneficial to both sides. I think ecologists used to always feel a little frustrated that they didn't have as much money to spend on laboratory work, doing the genetics and doing a lot of the toxicology that they'd like to do mechanistically. But on the other side, we were forced to then think of other approaches and ways to deal with things. And as such, two very different ways of thinking have emerged, and yet they're very complementary. So we definitely go out, and if we have biomarker information, for instance, on fish, we'll definitely take that and use that in this case. And it can become very, very important. In one risk, one causal assessment that Glenn Suter did, he looked at population modeling, for instance, and that was in a terrestrial system. And Michael Kravitz looked at metals and was also looking at uptake and other issues that we often would not necessarily have that data in a stream system, but in a Superfund site there might be enough. For a hazardous waste site, there might be enough information available to use it.
And would you think when you're moving from your kind of general causation to specific causation, is that where you would find is that where you would find that the application of the biomarker kind of information or does that give you more specific almost to go, you know, from thinking in human health terms, I would think of almost going from national level to community level, or from population level to individual level. Is that the kind of
are there types of evidence that, that lend themselves, or do you break your types of evidence up along the kind of general causation linkages and the specific causation linkages?
Yeah, we do. So we might be taking just evidence from the case. So for instance, in the Willimantic example, upstream, downstream, you know, that only comes from the case. But because it's only from that case, you just don't know if it's just luck that you happen to be there on that particular day. But in addition, at the heart of every one of these causal assessments are is a causal relationship that is established in some sort of scientific way that informs it, and that's the general one. And in that case, it's particularly useful, for example, is it sufficient? Is the stressor that's present sufficient to have caused the effect that I'm seeing in my dream? In a risk assessment, you may have that causal, that general causal relationship established, and you're using it to say, at my site, what's the probability at this concentration that I will have a bad effect happen? So it's at the heart of every one of them, whether it's a condition assessment, a causal assessment, outcome assessment, or a predictive assessment, there is that particular kind of information. I see we do have a question from Elizabeth Rochette. It says, how close in proximity does the reference site need to be valid? Does it need to be pristine, or can it have been previously remediated? The idea is it just if it's different from the impaired site, that's it. So it doesn't have to be pristine. It could be previously remediated. It just needs to be different from the impaired site that you're interested in. However, you know, the nicer it is, the better it is, and the easier your assessment is going to be. In fact, you can even flip it on end and have a site that's even dirtier or worse than your site and use it as a quote-unquote dirty reference. And that's another trick that you can use to try to tease out what's going on. Well, why is that site, you know, what does my site have in common with this really bad one? And it's not as good, but sometimes it's nice if you can do it both ways. Does that answer your question, Elizabeth? Hope so. In terms of proximity, some people have, you know, stuck to just upstream in a stream study, but other people have used the whole watershed, and it all depends on the question.
Okay, well, I think we are at the hour, so we will be signing off. Keep in mind, the next seminar in this series will be next Tuesday, two weeks from today, same time, 12 noon Eastern, and it will be Dr. Glenn Suter talking to the topic of integrating human health and ecological risk assessment.
All right.
Any final words, Andrew?
None at all. Thank you very, very much, Susan, for a terrific seminar. I'm looking forward to further conversation, and thank you, Chuck.